Give me a mountain with lots to do. Give me the sunshine, give me a dew. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good friends, give me a dew.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we are batters up with the TV adaptation of A League of Their Own on Prime Video, weathering the storm inside a hospital with Vera Farmiga in 5 days at Memorial on Apple, and finally able to tell the difference between our waking lives and dreams in the long-awaited adaptation of Neil Gaiman's hugely influential comic, The Sandman, on Netflix. And speaking of which, The Sandman himself, Mr. Tom Sturridge, and co-star Vivienne Achimpong join us a little later on the show to dream us a little dream about that. I'm James Dyer, the real one this time, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, your weekly guide to every show that matters, and one that has just about recovered from last week's insurgency, during which the rule of law was temporarily suspended in favour of, let's be honest, unfettered anarchy. With me, however, as we, you know, straighten the furniture and sweep up the debris and try and get those suspicious stains out of the carpet, are two of the anarchists in question, specifically Boyd, breederphile Hilton, and Beth, the Gilmore Girl, Webb. How are we? Did we have fun without me?
Oh, we had the most fun. We coloured outside the lines. We slapped the tables. We shook the microphones. We drank about 4 cans of fizzy pop each into the microphones. Risky was there, just sort of freestyling at one stage. It was glorious.
I don't remember any of this, but yeah. Apparently that's what happened.
I listened to it. You know, I must admit that sound quality was maybe not what I would have put up with myself, but fine. You know, who am I to judge?
Could you tell that there was like a 2 or 3 second delay?
I couldn't tell there was a delay, actually. Did sound like you were talking through like an 80s CB radio through time. Do you remember that?
Wow.
Do you remember Frequency, the film Frequency?
Yeah.
Where he's talking through time through the. Yes. That's basically what you were coming through. Felt like you were in the 1950s. Is talking to us in the present via the medium of ham radio.
Right.
So it wasn't perfect. But it was fun. I will say I didn't miss editing it. I didn't miss editing it. It was because I imagine the logistical nightmare of trying to piece that together. So, you know, thanks to the guy who did edit it, but it wasn't me. I'd quite like to have an editor. I'd like to have someone to just edit them so I never have to do it again. It was like genuinely last week, the holiday for me wasn't even just not being at work. The holiday for me was Monday came and I was like, oh, I've got to. Oh, I don't have to edit. I don't have to edit anything. And nothing at all. It was.
But I mean, you're lazy though, because you only have to edit one podcast a week. Doesn't Chris Hewitt has about like 5
every day? He does.
He's doing like spoiler specials.
I know.
Like on his way to work.
I know. Yeah.
I don't understand how.
Chris quite enjoys the act of editing.
Oh, does he?
He actually quite likes doing it. Whereas for me, it is my own personal hell. Like, I genuinely hate it with the fire and suns.
Okay.
So I will say, if you're a big fan of Pilot TV podcast and happen to be, I don't know, a podcast editor who doesn't mind being micromanaged within an inch of your life, then do drop me a line. You know, you might be able to work Oh, God. Something I should mention is that there are still a few tickets left for The Big Show.
Woo-hoo!
Not the wrestler, obviously. Pilot 200, which is on the 21st of this month. It's now just 2 weeks away.
Oh, my God.
2 weeks.
Is that true?
I'm getting a bit nervous, I've got to be honest.
Oh, my God, it is two.
It's 2 weeks away.
We better do some planning, hadn't we?
We had better work some stuff out. We're almost ready to announce some of the details of what's going on, so do keep an eye out for that, possibly later this week. I can say we're going to have an advanced screening of a show.
I can say that.
We're going to have a very special panel with some incredibly talented screenwriters on there, which would be very, very good. We have the star and creator of another very special show who's going to be on to talk about that, and some people involved with one of the most anticipated returning shows will also be coming down as well. And if there's a way for me to be more vague, I don't know what it is, but I will tell you at some point in the very near future. Not to mention there will be other things. There'll be the rematch quiz that we're doing with the Empire podcast team. There'll be a live mega banshee and so much more. It's very, very exciting. So do be sure to book your tickets as soon as possible. As ever, I will say the best value is to get day and evening tickets together, because the discount is kind of applied at checkout. That's not clear, but it is. And while you can Google the URL, it might drop you onto the page for either Pilot TV Live Part 1 or Pilot TV Live Part 2 without an obvious way of booking the other one. So I will say, if you want a simpler way of doing it...
You really got to earn these tickets.
Yeah, you really
do.
It's a bit like a, you know, there's like a treasure hunt, and then you go on to a riddle, and there's a sphinx, and then eventually we agree to sell you tickets. Or failing that, you can go to my Twitter at James C. Dyer, and my pinned tweet gives you a link to the splash page for the whole 200 event, which lets you buy tickets for the morning. Morning, it starts at 12:30. That's technically the afternoon, but the first part and the evening as well. Can't say fairer than that. Look forward to seeing all of you there. It's gonna be very good. Exciting.
Yeah. I'm very much looking forward to it. Mum's getting a haircut this weekend, ready for
is
it. Yeah. She's getting all glammed up. Can't speak for Steve, but he's not got that much hair, so.
Oh, fair enough. So it shouldn't take too long.
No, not at all.
He can come.
Spit polish.
If you like, so he can come and do the same hair and makeup trailer as Boyd and I.
Yeah, I'd be very busy.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. be very busy.
Yeah, I'd be very busy. A little bit of wax and you're done. Right. Okay.
James, your head, it's just struck me, we ever had this conversation, that your baldness is that you've got a very, I'm going to say, smooth, totally hair-free scalp, whereas I have like a number one crop, effectively, of whatever hair I have left.
Yep.
Do you deal with your hair on a daily basis?
This is welcome to the personal care segment.
Listen, can we not save this for the live event?
That just struck me, just how smooth and hair-free.
I do have a very smooth head. It can be
just naturally.
So do you have a grade one? Is that what you do?
Yeah, I have a trimmer.
How often do you trim? If that's
kind of every other day, pretty much.
Every other day. Okay,
so it's quite exhausting.
So if you would like the history of my hair, my James Dyer, I used to have a clippers, and I remember I started in my 20s with a grade 4, then I went grade 3, then grade 2, grade, and then grade 1. Then I went without the comb. That was a big step. But now I'm wet shave. That's why it's so smooth. I lather up with a bit of shaving gel I slide the razor over my head every morning.
I think I'm too scared to do it. It'll be a bloodbath.
Well, I will say, when one is running ever so slightly late for work, it can be quite fraught because you can end up kind of savaging yourself with blood everywhere and cutting your head to ribbons. So you do have to, you know, there's a skill to it. But I can do my whole head in, I would say, a minute 30, roughly. I do it really quickly.
That is efficient.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And I can actually do it now. I don't even use the mirror sometimes. Sometimes I just go in the shower and do it in the shower. I can do it all by touch because I'm so used to doing it now. I can do it touch.
This would make a great montage on Better Call James.
Do you think we should do this?
Yeah.
A James shaving his head montage.
Yeah. What music would you have accompanying it?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Probably... Foo Fighters, The Pretender.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I was going to throw that out there.
Oh, that's brilliant, yeah.
With lots of, quick cuts.
Yeah,
bit black and white, bit of grain in there.
Yeah.
You know, shot of the foam, shot of the water,
of the shower head.
Oh, yes.
Like, almost like in Tribute to Psycho, and you think this is going to be a horror scene, but it's actually a celebration of James's head.
Yeah. James just smiling, suds everywhere, just, like, having a little dance.
Yeah.
That could work.
Yeah.
That could work.
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, that's good. Okay, but thank you. Thank you for observing the shininess of my hair.
I'm fascinated,
I appreciate that. It's good. For more electric banter like this, do book tickets to the 200th episode.
You will be entering this in next year's podcast awards, right?
Yeah,
congratulations.
100%.
I don't think we've said it on there. Congratulations to Empire.
Yeah.
And you are core of the core gang that won the podcast award. Obviously, Chris Hewitt, I was listening to Chris Hewitt, and he almost celebrated the fact that we weren't nominated. Or, you know, he was like that. He literally was like, oh, they have great taste, you know. But that's because you didn't even enter us, did you? Let's face it.
That's accurate.
I don't mind. It's very time consuming to enter.
It is very time consuming.
So I don't blame you at all. I mean, fair enough.
I will enter next year.
Oh, good. But I thought it's a bit much for Chris to have a go. I mean, just celebrate your triumph.
It's on brand.
Yeah, it is on brand. You're right. But what a magical. Magical thing.
For those of you listening who don't know, we won the Best Live Podcast Award at the British Podcast Awards a couple of weeks ago. It was very, very
exciting. The Oscars of the podcast.
That's absolutely true. Idris Bigdris was there because his podcast was nominated. He didn't win and we did. not that I'm ever going to celebrate that, but we were up against some real heavyweights in our category. The Guilty Feminist was in our category. Mm. And I can't emphasize that. We beat The Guilty Feminist for Best Live Podcast, and that is fucking wild because they are amazing.
That is good.
So, but so much so did we not think we were going to win. A, we were sat at the very back of the tent and we were kind of talking when they were doing it. We weren't even really paying attention.
Of course you were.
Part of us were like, oh, you know, oh, we've kind of got to leave. And it's like, oh, we can do. And Andy Gaffney, who I've been on his, you've been on his Be Grand podcast recently, haven't you?
Yes, right.
I've been on that as well. He's got another podcast that he's done, Promenade, and that was up for Best New Podcast. And he texted me and he said, oh, look, would you accept? I can't be there. A friend was getting married or something. And he said, could you, if I win, could you go up and get it for me?
Oh my God.
And so I was really only hanging around in case he won.
Right.
Because I was like, well, guys, like, we could go, but I've got, if Andy wins, I'm going to have to go pick up his award. And like, I was like, shit. And then when we won, I was like, oh shit. Like, I came this close to going because there was a tent out the back with free ice cream. And I was like, it's free ice cream. Wow. I'll sit here and be bored. I was like, fuck me. But we won. And it was wild.
My brother was there as well. My brother's
was
podcast.
He?
Yeah, he's got a podcast called Manatomy. I'll give it a plug. And he got silver in his category. And that was Idris Elba presented that category.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was particularly exciting.
That is exciting.
So like, if literally like all colleagues, friends, brother was there, you know.
I didn't know you had a brother.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
Hoyd Bilton.
Hoyd.
Yeah. But just a reminder, I mean, absolute triumph that you won. We have won an award already.
Yes. The Published Podcast Awards we won in 2020.
Oh, I remember
the one
that
with glitter
very
in it.
Sweet photo of you two.
Exactly.
The
one
awards.
With glitter in it.
But also important to know is that we won this award for Empire 500, and Pilot 200 is basically completely ripping that off. So obviously, Pilot 200 will be an award worthy event, and I think we should all celebrate that. But let's celebrate what we've been watching on the screen. So, what has the last week involved, people?
What have we watched? I mean, let's just kick off a Better Call Saul, shall we?
Yeah.
Where are you?
Okay. Mini spoiler special.
Yeah.
Okay. They can rant now. Obviously, like fascist spoiler rules still apply because I am now, as we speak, I have burned through season 5. I am now on season 6, episode 5.
God.
Oh my God.
So I am only like, 6 episodes now behind where we are.
Oh, shit.
So I am closing in on this. Now, how many episodes are in this final season? Is it?
It's 13. Yeah, there's two more
13.
To go.
So I've basically got 2 weeks to catch up.
Yeah, there's two more.
I'm there.
When this goes out on Monday, that last one, the penultimate, will drop next day in the UK, Tuesday morning, and the finale is the following week. Yeah.
There is a problem, though.
Go on.
There is a problem. So I have, with a vengeance, pursued this show. I have just charged through it. And then Sandman came along.
Oh.
And Sandman is like 10 episodes long. And we're going to get onto this a little bit later, but Jesus Sandman has derailed it. But there was a bigger problem. There was a bigger problem than Sandman. And this came up. So we are reviewing a show on Apple later on called 5 Days at Memorial. And I went onto the Apple Press app to look at my previews.
Mm.
And I was scrolling through 5 Days at Memorial. Where is it? And I went back and I saw, oh, the icon has changed for C.
Oh no. Of course,
and
you recognise the change
the
in
icon.
The icon.
Jesus wept.
And all 8 episodes from the final season of C are on the preview app, and I lost my shit. So I haven't started them yet because I have to watch stuff for this show, but I'm now at this massive crossroads. So I've only watched half of Sandman, so I've got 5 Sandman episodes to go. I've got like 6 episodes of Better Call Saul, and I mean, the risk of spoilers is real. But C, the glorious C, is there in all its just majesty, and I just don't know what to do. I'm paralysed by the choice.
I would say crack on with Better Call Saul because I had something spoiled for me by a friend as well, which really hurt. But
a former friend.
Hmm. Who I don't have muted for the purposes that I thought he was better than this. And then on Tuesday morning, logged onto Twitter and the first thing he shared was something relevant to the plot of Better Call Saul. And I was fucking fuming.
That's absolutely furious. That's not good.
I'm stunned that you've not had it spoiled for you because
I've had nothing spoiled.
Right.
I'm doing so well.
Yeah, keep it up. You just need to get through it now. Just get it through.
Just plow through.
Just strap in and go.
You can't be diverted by C.
No.
Definitely can't be diverted by Sandman, which we'll get to that later. But
you shut your mouth right now. How dare you? But genuinely, like the thought of me, like to have all the episodes of C available not watch them is almost more than I can bear. So
Why don't you just look? Today's Thursday. You can easily plow through the Better Call Sauls between now and Saturday, and then you've got the weekend.
I'm just doing your schedule.
It's the weekend devoted to C. You've got to just delay gratification by 2 days.
You're absolutely right, but it's not as if I have one of those job things or anything.
Don't pretend your priorities are.
Oh. So I don't know.
You can definitely deal with Better Call Saul by the weekend and just put your mind to it and then see. Then you can get the whole thing seen. And Sandman, just fuck that. Leave that show.
Honestly. Shush.
Oh, we are for a fruity recording. So what was the last thing that happened with that you can... I mean, we can't spoil this for listeners, really, either.
We can't spoil it for listeners.
What episode were you up to?
I will say I watched the episode in which someone has a piece of glass in their hand. And that was...
Yeah.
That was a lot to deal with.
Yeah.
And then I also watched the episode after that, which involves some spectacular spray tan. And I will say that as well.
Oh, my God.
Which is magnificent.
Right. Wow.
And that is where I am at the moment. So I'm going into six, I believe, is the next one.
Wicked.
Yeah, so you've got two more. You're in two more before the mid-season finale. So seven is the mid-season finale. Oh, those two episodes are historic, yeah. So you've got
I know the Cinnabon one is coming. I know that's coming, but I don't think knowing that it's coming is a spoiler because I don't know what's happening in it.
Other than Jerry from Parks and Rec is in it, which
means nothing to me.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You've got six episodes to watch before Tuesday. Absolutely fine. That's fine. This is your schedule. Thursday, you watch three tonight, three tomorrow, Friday, see you the weekend. Back on, if you want, you can put some Sandman in on Monday, and then Tuesday you're ready for live watching of the penultimate episode. And the reason that works is because some American critics got to see the third from end episode, pre-penultimate episode.
Yeah,
and they for their recaps and their reviews the next day. I didn't. I got to watch all the episodes in this series on a Friday before they come out, so that I could write my review for Empire. But now no one in the world is getting to see the final two episodes at all before they go out. So or you can join us. Do you know what I mean?
Is it going to be like a screening? Are they going to put on like a press screening?
They haven't, not that I know of.
Because they did for Breaking Bad.
They did. Mm. Yeah, you're right. They did.
I'm just going to have to get up at like 7 but you just and have watch to get it. Up at,
I think it's 8 a.m. it arrives, by the way.
And again, I don't want to be watching this at 8 a.m. in the morning, but if people are going to be dickheads, then I'm going to have to, aren't I?
You're going to have to. But we should talk a little around the hat without any spoilers. A couple of things I was going to mention, you were going to say.
Yeah, I'll describe my feelings when watching this episode. Let me think about it. Discombobulated.
Mm, yeah, sure.
I'll say it.
Okay.
Mildly disappointed.
Oh, no, really? Really?
In comparison to the absolute highest of high standards that this season has maintained.
Oh, okay.
It is the best season, right? Like, it is the best
season. It is the best season.
It's thus far. It's getting better and better and better.
I mean, you can concur at this stage, it's by far the most devastating season.
Yes.
What I would say is, I'm not 100% surprised. I've seen some other people online say they were disappointed by it. I wasn't
mildly disappointed at
because
elements
you, yeah, because you're like, you're comparing some of the greatest episodes of TV that we've ever seen to, you know, that work. But what I would say is, I do think these final episodes, these final three episodes, including that one, in fact, no, the final four episodes, I feel like a kind of coda to the main action without spoiling anything.
Yeah.
And that it's almost like you're giving the characters and story kind of real time to breathe and they're kind of playing with time and blah, blah, blah. I mean, but I found it fascinating what they do with this third from the end episode. And I mean, it's called Breaking Bad. Mm. That's not a spoiler. It just is called Breaking Bad.
I don't want to know anything about it.
But so a couple of things I was going to mention. One, there's another montage. There's another extraordinary montage, black and white montage, on top of the extraordinary montage in the previous episode. And I have started listening to the official Better Call Saul podcast.
Chris Hughes mentioned,
and it is fascinating. And they talk about the challenge of doing these montages, because I mentioned last week how someone online had said, that find someone you love as much as Better Call Saul loves a montage. And it is so true, they do love it, but they do them beautifully. Mm. Like this one this week is like a work of art again, I felt. The music choice and everything.
Yeah.
All of the, you know, when it's going through the con. And I also thought, as a character study, it really showed you the core of the character.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Oh.
And
yeah.
There was that earlier scene where it addresses stuff that's been going on that you're all obviously wondering about. And we're all wondering in the end what's going to happen with the major characters in the final two episodes. Do we see who we don't we see? And I thought that teeing that up in the way it did, cutting that, this is what I say. There's a scene, James, in this episode and with Saul / Jimmy, and he goes to he uses a public phone booth and makes a phone call, and then it cuts the dialogue. You don't see hear what he's saying. Mm. You just see what is happening to him. And that was such a kind of like clever / unbelievably provocative bit of stuff.
Yeah. It uses that device a few times.
It does.
So that bit when Kim goes in and has that meeting, as it were, and she goes in, you just see her through the door.
Yeah.
And you just hear the mumblings through the door.
They're brilliant at withholding. But what I thought about that moment made it so interesting was they're doing that. I thought, okay, they're really teeing up some major stuff that's going to happen in the final two episodes. Mm-hmm. So while these episodes we're living through now feel like that coda, as I said, to the main, I think the final two are going to be much more not like that. So I think the final two, this is my just kind of, I have no idea, but really going to give us some major satisfying closure of some kind.
It's going to have to, isn't it? I think what I need to add to it is that I didn't love Breaking Bad. So the way that it is, the way that this episode called Breaking Bad is...
La, not listening.
It's relevant to
it's
that.
Doing what it's doing.
Right.
Is... not satisfying me as much as
have
somebody.
We established that you weren't that keen on Breaking Bad.
I've probably said it like 12 times on this podcast, but no one's listened or registered.
I prefer Friday Night Lights, thoughts. Beth. I've heard that's a show you might enjoy.
I prefer Better Call Saul, I have to say. I do, 100% now. Yeah. I mean, it's not even a question for me. Halfway through the whole thing, I was like, is this maybe possibly end up going to be better than Breaking Bad? But now I'm like, it's 100% better than Breaking Bad.
I'm not there yet. I think it's great. I really think it's great. But I think Breaking Bad has a... It has a cleaner story arc and a more sort of compelling central tenet, which I love. That said, once I get to the end of this, maybe I change my mind. But at the moment, like, they're both fantastic, but Breaking Bad still pips it for me. But
I find Saul, Jimmy, a far more compelling character.
He's good. He's very good. Mean, yeah. He's a very good character.
Yeah. So that's what I've watched.
Okay. Good.
Same. I kind of took over what you were watching. Apologies. Sorry.
It's fine.
I'm carrying on with Westworld.
See, I'm two episodes behind on Westworld because of Better Call Saul, and I'm desperate not to have that spoil because I was enjoying it enormously when I stopped.
I'm still enjoying it enormously. It's so much better than the last season. Yeah. It's so much better, and dealing with the big questions about AI and what is the difference really between an organic human being and a created host, as they're known in this show. And this whole show now is all about the hosts have taken over the world, basically, or at least New York. And there are outliers who are, and they've managed to kind of turn humans into hosts, into kind of like a cross between. They've managed to basically turn humans into things they can control, beings they can control. And there are outliers who are somehow avoiding that control. So it's just kind of. It's kind of reinvented the whole idea of the show in a really interesting way, and is addressing, for me, the fundamental flaws of Westworld, when it annoys me, where we're supposed to have as much empathy for hosts, basically, as we are human beings. Mm. But I think what this series is quite effectively doing is making you, the viewer, complicit in the moral problem of that, if you like. It's going, well, hold on, what is the difference between these, you know, if an AI being, a replicant, whatever you want to call it, all of those things that aren't fully organically human still have pretty much 99.999% of the thoughts and, in quotes, feelings as a human being, then what is the difference? And that it's really getting into that knotty thing, which I think the last series, and I almost think now, I literally can't remember anything that happened in the last series.
It was incredibly dense.
Because it was so dense, but just not, it was dense, but at the same time, not really making many interesting points about its whole premise. Whereas at least this is all, it's still confusing. Mm. It's still like, it jumps around in time. It does that thing where, this whole thing all along happened to be taking place 95 years ago. And we're only just going to tell you about it now. It really relies on that trick a lot, which it played that trick in season one, of course. That was the big twist. And it's really relying on that befuddling you by kind of every now and then reminding you that these timelines are not the same. It's just jumping between completely different times. But it's confusing still. There are moments where I still don't understand. You really have to pay attention. You really, like, I keep having to rewind it, you know, on my Sky Q to get to the bits where, why is he doing that? Why is she doing that? But even when you're confused, it's beautiful. Mm. The design, the production design, the fact that it's all set in this weird, in this future version of New York. And I was on holiday in New York last week. There's one bit of it filmed. There's a lot of it filmed in the Hudson Yards, which is this whole bit of in Manhattan, which is kind of they've got that massive giant sculpture. Mm. I took a picture on my Instagram if you want to see what I'm talking about. And they literally use that in Westworld as like, and yet they kind of enhance it with CGI. Extra buildings, you know, to kind of show even more densely packed than New York is now. But it just looks fantastic. The characters that are getting more screen time are my more favoured characters that are getting screen time. And so, yeah, it's definitely completely revived my interest in the show and my fondness for the show. And that's about it, I think. If there's a show, we'll get to later, shows that we...
Boyd and I went to a very special screening of a show last night, which I 100% can't talk about. Because I have never seen an NDA quite like this one, where it was not just an entire side of A4, it was in really tiny font size, in two columns across the whole thing. And it basically said, if you so much as, you know, hint in riddle form that you might have possibly been in the same postcode as this screening... on that night, we will send things after you.
Yeah, so, can't even talk about the trailers.
Can't even talk about the trailers, lest they kill us. So, but suffice to say, it's one of the most anticipated shows of this year, and we saw it, and we have opinions on it, but I'm not even going to share those opinions about a thing that we can't say that we saw. So,
no, sure I saw two things. I saw another thing before
you
that.
You did? That's
but
right.
But I also can't talk about another show.
Oh, this must be fascinating.
This
to the listeners.
Is so thrilling.
Yeah. It's not as much of an NDA. Did I sign an NDA? No, I can't remember. Because the NDA was so extraordinary for that thing that we were at. But the previous thing, which was really good. I can't remember whether I did sign an NDA.
Are we going to do a new section now of stuff we have watched but can't talk about?
We can't talk about.
Yeah. And it's just you two.
And we can't even say we talked about it. One thing a listener did... tweet you this morning, Boyd, and say, please, could you mention to James 17.4 million people watch the football?
I'm glad you saw that. Yeah, that is true. Yeah, the highest rated, I mean, that's in TV news. Yeah, the highest rated broadcast of the year was the Women's Euro final.
Rightly so.
17 million people watched it. Yeah.
I was not among them, as you wouldn't be surprised to hear, but I don't watch the men's football either. It's not a gender thing. I just find football tedious. Yeah. But I will say that I thought their press conference was one of the best things that's ever been on television.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
And I was like, I absolutely love the fact that is just a whole zero fucks given approach to speaking to the media. And it's just, I love them, and they should do all interviews on every subject from now on.
They are, I'm about to say something. I'm trying to avoid saying this in a crass kind of. But there's something about the way their post-match interviews, the England women's team, and that press conference. You're right. Sorry, I've hit the mic. Sorry. Editing nightmare.
Yeah.
The way they deal with post-match interviews, the women's team, and the way that press conference, they're so much more human and less kind of. They're just better. This is a generalization, a crash generalization than the men, but they just are.
Because they're
really
having fun. It's joyous. Like, I mean, there's something sort of just primal about it. It's wonderful.
I imagine it's different media training as well. I imagine those men's teams have been kind of meticulously.
Right. It's because men's football is the biggest thing in the world. It's the biggest money making entity in the world, football. And played by those men, and when they're getting, you know, some of them are getting, you know, £500,000 a week to do what they do, and whole football clubs are like Barcelona at the moment is almost like clinging on financially because it's desperation to buy a huge star player. It's just such a weird world that once you're a professional involved in it, you're immediately expected to behave in a certain way, and everyone's paying attention to every single last thing you do. James is going to cut all this out. I can tell because the way he's looking at me, he's like, "Why are you banging on about this?" But the women are just not in that. It's not like that. So yeah, they're not affected by that bullshit. Basically, and funny enough, the other thing I did go to this week, I also went to the premiere of Arsenal All or Nothing.
Do you know
Amazon Prime Video?
I was like, right. So I'm going to get into a podcast recording this morning, but that's come out and Sandman's come out. So I should probably pack a book Fuck.
Yeah, I'm not going to mention it, just to say that obviously it's Prime Video.
Boyd or nothing.
Yeah, yeah. It's
that would have been my intro while we were reviewing it, but we're not.
Can you imagine if I'd have tried to get you to watch that? Oh my God. But it was there was a delightful launch event at the Islington Town Hall, whatever it's called, and it was very, very exciting. And I've watched it 3 times.
Oh, good God.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's out now. All else the fans will be lapping out. But that is an insight into that whole. It does have very interesting insights into what young football players are like. That's all I'll say. I'll leave it there.
Fascinating. Okay. I'm going to say we are half an hour into the podcast.
Oh, God,
we haven't actually started the podcast. So I'm going to suggest we skip the listener question this week, although we do have one. So apologies to the person who sent that in. We will get to it next week, but mainly because we're going to get thrown out of the studio today. Our studio situation has altered. We are now doing these in the radio studios at One Golden Square. And let's just say everyone's a bit territorial about who gets what room, and the bookings are all a bit fascist. So
very warrior-y.
Yeah, we have a sort of, you know, it's a bit Hunger Games-y. You have to kind of fight for your time in the studio. So yes, we have some new tributes arriving in about half an hour. So let's press on.
Tributes.
Let's press on. I think it's time now for this week's guests. Rest assured, there will be much banging on about the Sandman later on this show, principally by me, by all accounts. But let's first hear about it from the stars themselves. Tom Sturridge stars in this show as Dream of the Endless, Morpheus, the Sandman, Lord of the Dreaming, and King of Nightmares. And Vivienne Achimpong plays his trusty majordomo, Lucien. The show sees Dream torn from his throne and summoned to Earth, where he's imprisoned by Charles Dance, as you would be, for 100 years. And when he finally escapes, he must recover his tools of state and fix everything that has gone to ruin in his absence. A bit like me returning from holiday, obviously. So here are Tom and Vivienne talking to longtime Sandman fan Helen the Corinthian O'Hara.
First of all, I'm a huge long-term Sandman fan. I could not be more excited about the show. I've loved it. I've watched the whole season already.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
But you guys just, you know, presented it in at San Diego Comic-Con. How did that go down? What was the reception like from the fans there?
I mean, it was kind of extraordinary. I've never been to Comic-Con before. I don't think you have.
No.
And I specifically, I'd never seen the trailer. It was the first time we'd seen the trailer. And so to kind of lean back into the 6,000 people there and watch it with them. And I, like you, like I'm in a spectacularly big Sandman fan. It was so moving to have created it or be a part of its creation, but also to be able to lean in and be a fan with all the fans and watch it for the first time.
I think that moment, especially presenting something like this in Hall H, can really bring home to people, you know, oh my God, we have this enormous fandom out there. How terrifying is that? I mean, from interviews I've read with you, certainly Tom, you were very much aware of that already, that this had a very passionate fan base. But, you know, is that something that both of you kind of confronted that day?
I mean, it felt really special. Because, you know, this has been 30 years in the making. For me, it just felt really special. And the people that were there wanted to be there. They wanted to celebrate Sandman, share this experience. So I think that's extraordinary. And it's just a beautiful thing because we were all together. You've got Neil Gaiman there. You've got Alan Heinberg. You've got the cast. You've got fans. It just all came together so wonderfully. It was an amazing experience. Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. And after 30 years in development, does this feel like the right time for Sandman?
I think it does. I think that the idea of making a film out of Sandman is kind of moronic. I think to distill...
Well, it is.
It is.
To distill 3,000 pages into 2 hours is just... It's actually the antithesis of what Sandman is. Sandman... You know, there's this kind of notion that Morpheus is a protagonist, which he is to an extent, but he's also a guide. He's a guide into the multitude of stories inside of it. Sandman is a story about stories. And so to try and pull one story out of it is just stupid. and I understand why it would have infuriated Neil, which it did. And so this is the right time because, you know, the beauty of long form television and the way that it's being championed at the moment is that you can take the time for Dream to guide you through all of the litany of stories that make up this cohesive behemoth that is Sandman. And also from a technological point of view, to realize hell and to realize the dreaming is difficult. And 30 years ago, you probably couldn't do it. It was difficult to find a gargoyle to fly over your head. Whereas now they're everywhere.
You can't get away from gargoyles. Yeah, I know it's such a problem.
It's a nightmare.
But I mean, that is a wonderful part of the comics, is that you have this, relatively speaking, narrative first couple of stories where Dream is more like the protagonist. But even in these 10 episodes, we're already kind of shooting off in different directions. We're already seeing different stories come in. And it just feels like we're ready for this world to open up around us.
Exactly.
100%. Yeah. 100%. I mean, I've watched all 10 episodes and I'm saying this, and not because I'm in it, but they blew my mind. They blew my mind because, as you said, you know, yes, it is about Morpheus and his story, but there are so many other stories that come out of it. And as someone watching it, it has made me question things, has made me think about things to do with myself. And it's, this work is extraordinary. And I'm just excited that we have been able to create it with the creator, Neil Gaiman, and bring it to people.
Okay.
Well, I wanted to ask about Neil, you know, because he has been very hands-on with this show.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm guessing, Tom, I'm guessing the answer to this is definitely yes, but Vivienne, I don't know. You know, did you sit down before shooting started? Did you get a chance to talk to him about your character before you started? And, you know, what was his advice to you?
Well, I mean, it was COVID times, wasn't it? So it was difficult for that aspect, but there was a lot of collaboration. And I'd say Neil was more than hands-on.
Yeah, yeah.
He's literally created this. He's
he wrote the first episode, pilot. He was there. He watched every frame every day. He would like give notes, encouragement. I mean, I did sit down with him a bunch of times before. I mean, the most important piece of advice he gave all of us, I think, was that, you know, he'd cast us for a reason, and that to trust that what he'd seen in us was what we should give, if that makes sense. Mm. As in, we you know, it was so clear what the Bible was, and that was Sandman and the graphic novels. But to trust ourselves. Mm.
And I wanted to ask about your relationship, because I feel like Lucienne has been brilliantly buoyed up from the comics. I feel like everything is there on the page, but it's been really, really drawn out for the screen. And your relationship between the two of you has really become a fantastic double act. Is that something you got a chance to rehearse before you started? Or you're winking at each other as you go or something?
It's just the joy. We didn't really, because kind of TV's not like that. The first day we met, we had a little bit of rehearsal, didn't we? Was it like 10 minutes or something like that? But what is amazing is that what has been created, like Thomas said, what has been created is we've got this amazing world. We've got Neil Gaiman, we've got the comics, we've got this amazing script that, you know, Alan has adapted. We've got amazing actors. Like, amazing what Tom has done with Morpheus, and the detail and how he's embodied it is incredible. So I just feel, because everything's there, you just trust it, and you trust yourself, and you just try to live in the truth and listen to each other and react to each other. And for me as an actor, that's the joy that I got with Tom, because he is Morpheus when we were filming. So,
But what I was going to say is also, there's something about the scrutiny that a camera gives on a face that you can't, that is different to the scrutiny that an eye gives to a comic square. Mm. And so, weirdly, I don't think that there's much dialogue between us that has changed, but the way we look at each other, like, you can see how we think about each other, which you just can't in a comic. And actually, potentially it is the same as in the books, but it's just that's one of the beauties of bringing something to life, is that you begin to see how these characters think, not only what they say.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does genuinely feel like Lucienne is his conscience to some degree, and certainly his most trusted sounding board at this point in the story.
Absolutely. It's the being that he spent the most time with. I mean, that's, we I often forget myself that there is no one. I mean, his siblings are a disaster, obviously. but there's no one that he has spent more time with in the millennia of his existence than Lucien.
So, Lucien, oh, I was about to say Lucien, Vivienne.
I mean, it's have very you... close, isn't it? It's very.
But did you? So, did you do any, you know, research on librarians? My sister is one, so I feel like I'm obliged to ask.
Oh, you're a good sister. Yeah, I mean, I'm of an age where I can remember going to the library. When I was little, this is such a good question because you just reminded me. When I was little, I used to pretend that I was a librarian. I actually genuinely did. You know, oh, when you went to the library and you had the little cards?
Yeah.
You had the little cards that you present. And oh my God, this is memories. And then I'd get loads of books that I had, because when I was young, I was obsessed with books. I didn't necessarily read them, but I just had, I love collecting, but I still do love collecting books. And then I'd just like write in them and be like, return in 2 weeks and put the date and stuff.
On your own.
That's just a memory that I've just remembered. Yeah, on my own.
Okay.
Wow. It was, well, this is obviously what Neil saw, right?
Yeah, this is yeah, what got me the job. Yeah.
That's amazing. And did you have any non-comic book sources that you kind of drew from for your performance or for your relationship?
I mean, yes, absolutely. I think there is a sort of tiny magic trick that takes place when you construct a character and you just steal from a thousand different things. But I think when actors start talking about the things they steal from, then like all magic tricks, you just realize that it's a terrible joke. So I might like save you from the music I was listening to. But the interesting thing about our relationship as well, I think, Lucien and Morpheus is that I do think that organically, through the way that we found each other, me and you, like during the course of the filming, I do think that Alan, kind of the showrunner and like lead writer, sort of like was surprised potentially by the way that it was going, yeah. And didn't change anything, but kind of leaned into it in a different way. Mm. I think, but what I'm saying is, what was exciting is we found things in the moment on set
organically,
just as much as we did from the script and from the books.
Yeah. And did you have much of a set? Because you two in particular, your conferences tended to be in the really weird, gorgeous, environments.
We really did. Yeah. That's what's extraordinary about this production, is that they were so anxious to remember the idea that when you dream, you don't know you're dreaming, you believe it's real. And so it couldn't be a kind of video game, which these things can often turn into, CGI fests. They built everything. You could touch everything. We shot, my throne room was shot in a cathedral. Mm. It was a real place.
The library.
The staircase up to the throne was built. Like the library was real.
The black sand that I had to run through.
All of it was palpable and tangible. And in these kind of, you know, fantasy projects, it's often such a leap of imagination. You're looking up at a castle burning. There's a gargoyle flying over, da, 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 da. And the thing, what was great about this is that the production design team really made that leap tiny because they gave it to us, and it made it so much easier to tell the truth.
And do you have to do anything differently when you're playing non-humans?
Absolutely. Well, but all that, I mean, what do you think of yourself? I actually never think of who Lucien is as far as what kind of being.
I don't think she even puts a. I don't know.
It's a label on it.
Yeah, don't put the label on it, darling. Do you know what I mean? No, not really. I mean, I loved my ears. The ears just took me to a different place.
Yeah. I think when you're playing an endless, it's dangerous to kind of start to think about it too much in the moment because it can become overwhelming. But one thing that Neil said to me that was really important to me was that Dream has had every thought that could ever possibly have been had. And so when he speaks, he's never finding anything as I am right now in the sentence. Like, he knows exactly what he's going to say, and he says it as if it's etched in stone, because it is etched in the stone of his soul. And that was a very great key into how to play someone who had experienced eons of existence.
And we're just finally, because I think, you know, Vivienne, most of your scenes were with Tom, but Tom, you got to act with almost everybody, it feels like, on this at some point. Did you have any kind of fanboy moments of people you'd particularly been wanting to work with or meet for a while?
Absolutely. I mean, working with David Thewlis, Stephen Fry, Gwendolyn Christie, they were, you know, it was thrilling. But also what was the most exciting thing is sometimes in, you know, projects like this, there's kind of sort of stunt casting just to kind of like give it a bit of oomph. And as someone who cares about these books so much, what was most beautiful was seeing these extraordinary actors so perfectly embody and realize the characters that I'd had in my head. Like when you see David Thewlis as John Dee for the first time in his pajamas on set, it was utterly like, I can't describe how magnetic, terrifying, and sort of beautiful and strange and peculiar his performance is. And then Gwendolyn, this kind of utterly seductive, beguiling, but immense presence. As you know, when I walked on set and she was Lucifer, there was no imagination required as how one would feel when confronting the ruler of hell. And Stephen, I mean, Fiddler's Green, aka Gilbert, like, I mean, genuinely, like he's I feel like he was, the comics were drawn for him. Yeah. I mean, there isn't a more perfect embodiment of the greatest intellect and fundamental kindness than Stephen Fry.
Amazing. Look, I love it. I can't wait for people to see it. Thanks so much for chatting to us. And I hope to see you again in season two.
Thank you so much.
And working Cheers. With Vivian.
Yes. The interview's over. It's too late, isn't it?
It's all right. We'll add it in.
Give me a mountain with lots to do. Give me the sunshine. Give me a dew. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain.
Grab some friends and an ice-cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew!
Right, shall we dive into this week's news? Now, there's quite a few things happening today, but one thing I wanted to mention was a thing that kind of popped up actually this morning as we record, which was some news from Camp HBO. It's like, I don't know what's going on at HBO at the moment, but it's slightly chaotic. So obviously the big film news we won't talk about, because we're not a film podcast, is that the Batgirl movie is no longer going to be a movie. It's going to be a tax write-off, which is a whole can of worms. But there was a thing this morning where The Wrap is reporting that 70% of the HBO Max development team are expected to be laid off. Wow. And they're folding HBO Max into HBO. So they're not, we think, going to be doing HBO Max scripted shows anymore. And HBO are going to be taking over. So fewer scripted shows overall.
I think that's pretty depressing, isn't it? When you think about how some of our favourite shows and some like milestone shows of the last few years have come out off the back of that. And I've seen today that they have, you know, James Gunn has already come out and said the second season of Peacemaker is safe. I don't have the strength to think about Barry. It started filming, but actually, you know, Batgirl was shot and that still went. So I'm just like clinging on that we can get the final season of that out. But it's really fucking worrying. It's really fucking worrying given the absolute bullshit, cold, sort of detached way in which Batgirl was cut, which does feel relevant because it seems to be all wrapped into the same strategy. That there are shows like Hacks at risk, you know, shows that are bold and creative with diverse casts, diverse creatives behind it that, you know, the proof is in the pudding. They've won loads of awards. They've been renewed for season upon season. And now, you know, without 70% of development, what are the chances of shows like that being made again? You know, maybe we'll be able to hang on to some of the ones we've already got, but the thought that we wouldn't be able to get more is just ridiculous. It's a weird time. I think it's a shame. You know, HBO obviously puts out extraordinary stuff. They're great for bolstering new talent as well. You know, really getting kind of people off the ground. And the fact that that is going to be potentially probably taken away is really jarring, I think, because we haven't even spoken about what's going to happen with And Just Like That. So, you know, that is the biggest casualty.
That is the true victim.
You know,
the
Carrie just
like
found love again. So I don't know. Yeah, I'm worried, and I think it's pretty appalling in terms of kind of a decision for what seems to be such a transparent profit grabbing sort of move. Yeah, it's pissed me off, I think is the...
Yay, capitalism, says Beth. Yes.
Yeah, it's well, pretty shit.
But is Barry... just? I think Barry is an HBO show.
Is it HBO proper?
Yeah. Oh, so I think you're fine. Yeah, I think you're fine. I think it is... it's difficult to know at this point what this really means because...
Yeah, we don't know.
Because
don't
I do feel like HBO is still, as you were saying, is still the creator of the best shows on TV. HBO, not HBO Max.
Sorry, but The Expanse was on Prime Video.
Yeah, and C's on Apple.
And C is on Apple, so,
yeah, true. But apart from those, HBO is still, you know, Mare of Easttown was HBO.
Of course.
You know, and obviously, like... it's got to the point where, for us, for me particularly, I'm constantly, every week there's another new show, and you're like, so that's an HBO Max show, but it's going to end up on BBC Two. You know why? The confusion is high, but I don't think this story, I don't think this news necessarily means there will. I think there'll be fewer shows, but I think there are a lot of HBO Max shows that aren't as key to, you know, to our world as HBO shows is what I'm. And I still think there'll be loads and loads and loads of HBO shows, you know, that are really, really good. So I don't think it's the end of the world. I don't think it's as, put it this way, I think the Batgirl story was just fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
I always thought it was weird that the HBO Max HBO relationship and the existence of a streaming version of HBO that's really similar to HBO, that has the same shows as HBO plus other shows, scripted shows, on what the difference between commissioning one for HBO Max and the other for HBO, it was always a bit weird, of a weird situation. So the consolidation of it, to whatever extent they're doing that, kind of makes sense.
I guess
the Batgirl thing doesn't make sense on
it. No, it doesn't at all. But what concerns me is the development.
Yeah, sure.
People going, who are responsible for seeking out younger talent, burgeoning talent that perhaps wouldn't get, you know, it's not David Simons, you know, they're not going to just instantly land a show on HBO and get that kind of budget. It's for emerging talent, and in there lies some potentially really exciting projects, really exciting opportunities. Hacks being a great example of that. Obviously, Gene Smart is an established actor, although this was a career best role for her. The fact that potentially it's going to scupper more shows like that being made with an incredibly diverse, queer, largely like development team, I think is what the worrying part is potentially it's going to stunt the kind of stories that we see on screen.
That is a worry for sure.
Well, HBO did do one good thing this week. I think we can all agree. They announced the release date for season 2 of The White Lotus.
They did, yes. October. Yeah, two really good things this week. That and, of course, as I've just mentioned, my beloved Barry has started filming, and it's just so funny to watch Henry Winkler, all the selfies of them all grinning and smiling and being so joyful and happy to be back in each other's midst, knowing full well that what they're shooting is horrible. Like whatever they're filming at the moment, because the third season ended on such a tragic, like gut-wrenching note. So they'll be picking up from that. Like the stuff the characters are doing is not joyful and happy, but all these like gleaming, like just Bill Hader just beside himself, just so happy to be there. And you know that he'll cut and then he'll go and probably like gouge someone's eyes out with his bare hands or something. It's very funny to watch, but I'm very, very excited about that.
The question about White Lotus is, because they announced that HBO showing October, they haven't, but Sky has not announced when it's showing it. That's the big question. Because I'm pretty sure from memory, I think they showed it pretty soon after it aired in the States, season 1. I don't think they waited. Put it this way, sometimes Sky waits so they can put the whole thing out as a box set. I don't think they did that with Series 1. And I hope they don't do that with Season 2. That news story about Season 2 coming out in October, when you see the cast list, just a reminder of the cast list for The White Lotus. Yeah. I mean, Coolidge, Jennifer Coolidge, F. Murray Abraham, Tom Hollander, Michael Imperioli from The Sopranos, Aubrey fucking Plaza, Theo James, Will Sharp, you know, the writer, director, wunderkind, whatever you call him. It's just a fucking incredible cast again.
It always is. This is what I mean. It's what I said last week. We are just in such a golden sort of renaissance of wonderfully cast ensemble shows. Yeah. Like you were saying with The Resort last week. Yeah. Like just incredible. Like we're spoiled, I think, for those. Yeah,
very much enjoyed listening to your discussion of The Resort and how the phone had charge, whether the SIM card was removed or left in the phone. It's that kind of granular detail that you just don't get on other podcasts.
If only you'd been there and you could have dived in with your little tuppence worth.
Well, yes. I noticed that you skirted over all the Comic-Con announcements and left all that to me. So,
this could be your little Comic-Con moment.
Well, I think we did record, as you pointed out, a special hour-long Comic-Con, an hour and a half-long Comic-Con special. But yes, they laid out Marvel Phase 5. They laid out Marvel Phase 6. They're going to keep us busy on spoiler specials for a very long time to come. All good. I'm pretty excited about everything. There wasn't an X-Men announcement. This is more of a kind of a film thing, but I'm imagining that will be something about that D23, which is...
And did they announce there was going to be like 120 episode Daredevil series, didn't they?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. That's going to be a long one as well. So your mileage may vary on whether or not those kind of episode counts. It was like 20 per season, or wasn't it? Like, that's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot.
And obviously the 13 episodes felt long, but I kind of think like if they chose to do it, they didn't need to do this long. Mm. I think they've obviously done it for a reason, so I think that's fine. While we're on Disney Plus, I would say, so She-Hulk's moved back now. It's no longer been on Wednesdays. It's now moved to Thursdays.
Right, why is that?
I'm assuming so there's not an overlap. So they've moved that over to Thursdays, and now Andor has gone back a month, and now that's the 21st of September. So I am doing an official reverse dank ferric on Andor, because that trailer that dropped was really good.
Like, and I'm really going to put, I was there from the start. I was the OG.
I know.
I was the OG. It's cracking, isn't it?
It looks really good.
I love being right. That score.
Yeah. And it just looks like a really interesting texture to it. And the period that it's set in, what it's exploring in terms of imperial politics, looks really interesting. It feels has a real kind of like political thriller feel of it. And also, it's not on that fucking LED volume, which has become the bane of my existence since Obi-Wan and ruined that series for me. So just having it on actual locations, it looks like it costs a million times more than Obi-Wan, which I'm sure is not the case.
Yeah.
But I just think, you know, guys, location, location, location. It is the key to all this stuff.
He's not talking about Phil and Kirsty.
No, I don't know who these people are, but no, I'm not talking about them. But I also noticed last week a very glaring omission in your news section that you did not report the biggest news story of last week. And I think it's very remiss of you. And of course, that is that we finally have a date for the long anticipated season 2 of Fate the Wink Saga, which is coming to Netflix on September the 16th. Come on, Bloom the Fire Fairy.
Wow.
I'm pretty stoked. Are you stoked?
I genuinely get confused as to which is which, because Lock and Key, which we're not reviewing this week.
That's coming this week with the third and final season.
Right, and what's the difference between the Fate the Wink Saga and Lock and Key?
So Lock and Key is the one where they have the magic keys in the magic house.
Yes.
And Fate the Wink Saga is the one with the school for fairies.
Yes, got it, right.
And
okay.
You watched all of Fate the Wink Saga.
Yeah, I did, yeah, really I quite enjoyed it in the end, yeah, I did.
But
yeah,
so what I need to find out is whether or not it's actually good, or whether it was a kind of a lockdown delirium, because it was one of these things where it was in the midst of lockdown, we'd all gone a bit doolally, and I got really into this YA show about fairies. And, you know, you might argue that that's not a million miles away from the kind of stuff that I like, so maybe I'm genuinely going to like it, but I'm looking forward to that. And Carnival Row, we've still not heard when Carnival Row is coming back, speaking of fairies. So season 2 of that, where Cara Delevingne is a fairy.
Totally forgot about Carnival
Row. I need more of that as well. So fairy goodness coming your way.
Can I just say, The story about She-Hulk, which has been announced on Variety, right, as we speak, this is pointless to mention, because by the time this comes out on the book, but as we speak, I have not received an email from Disney about that, telling me that date has moved. So I'm relying on Variety and assuming, because I'm going to have to change my preview of
it. It's like, I am shocked. I have not been personally informed by Kevin Feige that this has moved. I refuse to believe until Kevin picks up the phone and tells me himself.
But I genuinely haven't had any press release about it. That's just weird that the Variety has literally said it's been put back a day.
I think they've done it specifically for the Empire Spoiler Special podcast so that we don't have a meltdown and have to do multiple episodes on a day. Okay. So I think it's really just a favour from Kev to us.
That makes sense. Yeah, fair enough.
I think so.
The really most exciting news of the week, though, in terms of project announcements, surely has to be the coming together of one of your favourite TV creators and my favourite.
Yes, the creator of C, actor. Stephen Knight. Yes.
Is going to work with Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did think you very fun. I saw that. Yeah.
I mean, dream combo.
Yeah.
What a dream collab. This is a limited series titled The Veil, described as a thriller that explores the surprising and fraught relationship between two women who play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, the other a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. This looks like high concept, like sci-fi gubbins with Elizabeth Moss involved. Written by Stephen Knight, who is an absolute maverick loose cannon when it comes to this kind of stuff. That is really exciting.
I mean, it could be high concept. It could just be two people on a road trip having a conversation. Like, it's not entirely clear from the synopsis.
No, you weren't listening. One is on a mission to reveal the secret before thousands of lives are lost.
Yeah, it could be a really juicy piece of gossip that would undo the fabric of society. Who knows? Who knows?
Okay.
I'm just saying, at no point did they say one of them's an alien. Like, it's like, you don't know.
Oh, that's true, yeah. There may not be a, you're right, yeah. There may not be a... it's definitely high concept.
But put it this way, I will be watching it 100%. Yes.
We'll be watching it.
You know, it's unclear whether Bubba Voss will appear in a kind of crossover event, but Stephen Knight, it could happen. But we spoke about She-Hulk briefly, and obviously She-Hulk stars Tatiana Maslany, who is fantastic. She's playing She-Hulk. She became famous for multiple roles in Orphan Black. Kristen Ritter, who was, of course, Jessica Jones, is going the other way, and she's going to be starring in an Orphan Black sequel series, which is called Orphan Black Echoes, which takes a, and I quote, deep dive into the exploration of scientific manipulation of human existence. So, there you go.
Awesome.
Yeah. I mean, Orphan Black was really, really good, so that would be an exciting one. And Kristen Ritter's also very, very good as well. So that's exciting. Beth, at Atlanta, there was a trailer for season 4 of Atlanta. Did you see that?
I didn't see it, no.
Have you turned?
I've withdrawn slightly. I was a little bit let down by that season, to be honest. Yeah, it's not for now. But I just had some qualms with it, and I'll watch it. I love them. I love the cast, but I think the writing let it down a bit this season.
Okay. Well, it lost me with that ridiculous first episode of the new season. So, sorry. Other things that are lost, First Lady has been cancelled.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, I don't like to, I'm not saying, you know, I'm not pleased when anything is axed, but that is the right decision.
Okay.
That series just did not work. It was just a weird waste of that, of a concept, really.
And a lot of talent.
Yeah, exactly. We'll always have OT Fab Bentley as Barack Obama. He was great. He was very good.
And the other thing that I've got, so obviously Stranger Things 5 has finally... Writing has finally begun on the fifth season. So they are writing the final season of Stranger Things.
I didn't even see that story. I assume they've been writing it for months.
No. They've just started day one. They put up a tweet of, and it's literally a whiteboard, and it just says Stranger Things 5 at the top. And the writers from are like, right, we're beginning.
To be fair, they're probably still rewriting season 4 after it had gone up, and they were just throwing in and editing new bits of it.
That tweaking thing is wild, but they're still messing with it. It's like they've gone full George Lucas. Like, guys, let it go.
Yeah.
It's like me with this podcast.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, no. Boyd's done this then. I've got to do a drop in. There's a whoosh coming. It happens. So, you know, so I sympathise. You know, I like to think me and the Duffer Brothers are in many ways peers in this regard. So,
absolutely,
you know, creators that we are. Any other news before we press on?
I think it was good to see that Shooty Gatwa confirmed that he's definitely in the next series of Sex Education, because people were speculating. Mm. I think you actually.
Well, that would have been a massive loss to that show.
That he wasn't, because he's been cast as the Doctor, obviously. But he will definitely, obviously Eric will be back in season 4 for sure, alongside his friend Otis.
Yes.
Played by Issa Butterfield.
Seamless. No one will ever know that you got the names confused in the previous take. okay, great. Let's move on then to this week's reviews. And we begin this week with a particularly interesting challenge, because the first one up this week, we have A League of Their Own, which takes us back to 1947, a cast of all new characters, sorry, no Madonna this time, and in a spin-off of the 1992 Gina Davis / Tom Hanks movie about the World War II All-American Professional Women's Baseball League. At which point I would normally say, Boyd, is this one in a league of its own? But I can't, because it turns out that even though we have watched this, and even though we have prepared our thoughts on this, an email may have sort of wound its way into our inbox this morning saying, guys, remember, this is embargoed until Wednesday. So what we now have to do is review this without reviewing it in some fashion that does not violate the embargo, which may not be as ironclad as the embargo for the special secret thing that Boyd and I saw last night, but still is an embargo. So have at it, Boyd.
Well, it's a tough one, isn't it? Let's just say it was a blow when I received... I was thinking, you know, it doesn't matter, because sometimes... It's all print reviews. Embargo on print reviews are what they really focused on. When I say they, I mean the gatekeepers of all the TV shows we review, basically. And so sometimes they kind of do play fast and loose, and they're like not that bothered of whether we cover stuff. Remember with the Paramount Plus? We basically reviewed 95 shows that were all coming out.
And still got shit from people for not doing every episode of every one of them.
But I remember, actually, they were in theory embargoed. a lot of those rooms for.
I did get permission to.
You
break
got permission,
though,
right?
Yes, I asked them before to break the embargo.
And I've had chats, you know, with this is quite boring insider bullshit. But I've, you know, with publicists, like, oh yeah, we don't mind too much, you know. It's an ambiguous thing, but we were like, oh okay, we've got these screens of A League of Their Own, and then I was just reminded this very morning that the embargo is Wednesday, 2 days after the podcast goes out. So it's not the best thing. But so what we can say is,
well, we can talk about what it
we've
is.
Definitely seen it.
Yes.
It's definitely like, it's a really good idea. So I would say this, to create a TV series in 2022 that is spins off from the film, the League of Their Own film, which was brilliant with Rosie O'Donnell, and Madonna was in it. And the whole idea of the film was, directed by Penny Marshall, that there was actually, in the wartime period, in the Second World War, when men were busy fighting, that they got women to create a league of to play baseball, to keep the public interested in baseball. That's a kind of simplified version of what was going on. But I love that film, by the way.
Yeah, so do I.
Such a loved. And I think, but obviously creators of TV shows are always looking for, you know, things that they can use that have been on, you know, all kinds of IP of any kind. It's just better to create a show that has some kind of brand already for it. And sometimes it feels like they're doing that in a crass, exploitative, stupid way, but this is absolutely not one of those examples. Yeah. This was like a really good idea to me.
Yeah.
And without reviewing it in detail, let me just say that if you liked the tone, that the film has this kind of breezy, very, very accessible, wryly funny tone to it that this captures really well. And yet it doesn't feel in any way like a dated way of dealing with it. It feels very modern in the way it deals with sexuality, more modern than that film. The way it's up front, it takes the sexuality stuff and the race stuff and puts it up front in that first episode that we've all seen that we can't review.
Yeah.
And it does it very, and it possibly does it very, very well. Possibly.
It looks like it might do it really well.
So my way of avoiding the review is, it's a really good idea they've done this. Whoever came up with it, that film that came out, because it's a long time ago that film came out.
30 years.
Fucking hell, that is incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, whoever came up with the idea, kudos, because it to really work. As an idea, it really works. And the execution, I think, may well be really good as well. So I would be surprised if anyone feels let down in any way when they clap eyes on this series that we're not allowed to review.
Beth, how do you think you will feel when you experience this embargo TV series?
And I need to add an extra in keeping in line with this scrappy show at the moment. We're in this new place. I don't have access. My internet's gone down, so I can't access any of the notes that I made at the moment. So I am going to borrow some of your Wikipedia pages. Salman's going to be funny. so I will skirt around this by saying, in our issue of Empire that's out this Thursday, I had the real pleasure of speaking with Abby Jacobson.
Oh wow!
Who we'll know from, she's the co-creator of Broad City with Alana Glazer. And she's co-created this show with a guy called Will Graham, who I believe is also involved.
Friend of Hannibal Lecter's.
Have I got that right?
Yes, Will Graham, yeah.
Oh, look at me go! And he, I think, was also involved with Broad City, and they've co-created this. And what I spoke to Abby Jacobson about, do you see how I'm doing this? What I spoke to Abby Jacobson about was how she brought a modern spin to this beloved, as we said, Penny Marshall film, by bringing in a lot of different stories. So it's worth mentioning with this, you know, there's that key scene in A League of Their Own where Gina Davis's character runs up and there's a black woman who's a baseball player, and she throws a wicked hand or whatever it's called. I don't do sports, which just shows how much I love this film.
Played a wicked hand.
Oh, she plays a wicked hand. Where she thinks she's going to throw it. Thank you. Yeah. Where she thinks she's going to throw it to Gina Davis, and it actually goes even further, and it goes to a player even further down the pitch, and they're like, what the hell? And it's this one singular scene. In this show, the black characters are as key to the show as the white characters are. There's also multiple queer love stories within this show, which are depicted authentically and are written really wonderfully. Abby Jacobson is a queer showwriter as well, so she's kind of brought her own spin to it in that respect. So taking something as beloved and wonderful and that really stands up as well, you know, 30 years on, I rewatched it this year, it still stands, it's still absolutely wonderful. To take that, preserve everything that is wonderful and great and good about that film and bring it into somehow bring it into a modern day while maintaining that it's set in 1947 is exactly what we spoke about in that story and how she did that and how it really, 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 really works.
Well, that is a sounds like a very informative interview you did there. Well done. I did not do any interviews. I did watch the trailer for this before, before sitting down.
Yes, the trailer.
I enjoyed the trailer. I thought it was good. I didn't enjoy the trailer as much as I enjoyed the trailer for the original film, I have to be honest. Like, it has the same sort of warmth, which I think the original did have, but the trailer for this, obviously short, because only 2 minutes long trailers. I
can't really get a
real feel for it from those 2 minutes. But I will say I was quite drawn into some of the sort of the new characters. As you say, lots of different stories being told, and some of the characters have very interesting stories. So it kind of it feels very textured because it has more room to breathe in this particular trailer. Like I say, the trailer itself, not that much longer than the trailer for the film, but certainly gives the impression that it's dealing with stories in a sort of broader, more in-depth way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think this has got legs, and I look forward to seeing other things that are not the trailer and are in fact the full show, which I think I will enjoy.
I also really enjoyed Darcy Carden in the trailer, who plays Janet in The Good Place.
Got to do
some really, really amazing, cool stuff, hot stuff in that trailer.
Very good, very good. That is, in fact, the trailer for A League of Their Own, which is embargoed until Wednesday, but does land on Prime Video on...
12th of August.
The 12th of August. The 12th of August. Right, next up we have Apple's 5 Days at Memorial. Now this one is based on the 2013 non-fiction book by journalist Sherry Fink, and it sees Vera Farmiga as a doctor at New Orleans Memorial Medical Center when Hurricane Katrina hits, throwing the hospital and of course the entire city into crisis. And who better to tear through this one than Hurricane Beth?
Oh God, could you imagine that hurricane? A nightmare. Yes, I am going to have to borrow from Boyd on this, I'm sorry. Yeah, so not in my wheelhouse generally, this show. I'm not really down for kind of like nonfiction disaster-led stuff. I like Vera Farmiga, obviously. She's incredible. And I did bristle slightly when there's a lot of establishing sort of the first half of this. So you've got her, Dr. Anna Powell, who is like a deeply religious doctor. And I've got to say it, unless you're a... All the doctors and shows have got going for them usually are they're sexy, aren't they? Your ERs, your Grey's Anatomy, sexy doctors is usually it. Throw in religion and you're in trouble, I think. You're just like, oh God, like a religious hot doctor. All right. And it's primarily sort of, she's sort of shown as one of this cool cast next to sort of the other person that really stood out to me is Cherry Jones, who plays someone called Susan Mulderick. I am reading this off Boyd's screen. I could not do this on my own. Who's sort of she keeps him around. She's sort of head of damage control. And it's a slow burn, this episode. So it starts with kind of the beginnings of the day, the wind sort of whipping through the trees and things. We know what's coming. And then it is this like, real. I was not expecting to like this as much as I did, and I really did like this by the end of the first episode. This real kind of pot boiler pressure cooker of an episode, where it goes from kind of the ins and outs of I even forgot the cold open. There's an opening which I won't go into that establishes things with a real sort of punch in the face, and then it goes into establishing the hospital. You do have that in the back of your mind. And then you know, you ultimately know what's coming, but when the shit hit the fan, is it the last 10 minutes of that episode? I think it is, when you really are, you're literally in the crux of the storm, and the hospital that they're in is being ripped apart, basically. And it's just astonishing how it goes. I think it really is a testament to the writing with this, like how it goes from... Even with the warnings and things that they're going about it as a normal day, and you believe that that is what you would do in their position as well. Like there's nothing kind of untoward as to how these medical professionals are going about their day, checking in with the patients, taking care of the patients. You know, it's established really, really well. It's a normal kind of environment that then, yeah, you just, it really makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, I think, with this. And by the end, I haven't watched the next episode of this yet, but I definitely will be. I knew it was going to be interesting, but there is a real kind of disaster movie element to this that I really didn't see coming. Like the budget that they put into this, the effects, there's a really chilling moment where a patient who is not very lucid kind of walks away from the ward, and he's going to kind of look out of a window, and he's just staring at this incoming storm, this very real incoming storm. And it's just chilling. And then of course you know what's coming, and you know what's going to come next, and all the political turmoil that came from it as well. But obviously it's just very, very, very focused on this emergency room and these people. And Vera Farmiga is incredible in this as well. She gets to do some really like dangerous stuff towards the end. I was really gripped by this, and I like to be, you know, I like to be surprised by stuff. So I was very into this.
Also nice to see Apple's camera being broken out again.
Yeah, someone tweeted about this, didn't they? Like there is like a, I don't get the techie stuff, but yeah, there seems to be some rhyme and reason behind it.
I thought this was fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it is yet another. I mean, it is like we're being paid by Apple, but we're not. I mean, we're really not.
No, we're not. Surface.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, Surface, yeah. This has a really interesting backstory as well, because this was originally going to be the second series of American Crime Story.
What?
American Crime Story, which started with the OJ series, which is an absolute masterpiece, and then ended up Gianni Versace was the second season. But there was a point where Ryan Murphy wanted to tell this story of the of Hurricane Katrina, and how and the crime, if you like, of it is the mistakes that were made everywhere, you know, all over the place, from the people within the hospital to the politicians to the police, et cetera, to the huge amount of crime that happened in and around the whole situation, which it does touch on. I've watched three episodes, but episode two particularly starts looking at the kind of the criminal activity, terrifying, because basically the whole city turns into this kind of anarchic, you know, crime wave on top of the physical disaster that has been wrought by the hurricane itself and the loss of power and all of that. It just becomes this kind of horrendous, horrific situation that kind of pans out in all kinds of really scary ways. But what's interesting is that I think the technology of visual effects has improved so much, like year on year.
Yeah.
If this had been made like a few years ago, say 5 years ago, as American Crime Stories season two, then it wouldn't have been as amazing, because the technical stuff in this, the way you, for example, it just in one of the early scenes, whole of New Orleans flooded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh yeah, it's just flooded. It's almost like you're watching a documentary.
I was thinking, how did they do
it? How the fuck did they do it? And every single shot of the hurricane itself and of the damage that it wrought is just so completely believable.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. So on a technical level, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Then I think it's brilliantly. It's an adaptation of a book which was called 5 Days at Memorial: Life and Death in a Storm Ravaged Hospital, by Sherry Fink, who's a journalist, and I think worked as in the medical field as well. So she kind of had all the expertise needed to write. But as an account of people stuck in the middle of the most extraordinary situation that you can't conceive of. They know this hurricane is coming, the workers in this hospital, like the officials, if you like. There's one, you know, brilliant stuff about the official looking through the book of, you know, of a guide to what to do in these disastrous situations. Of course, there is no guide to what to do when the worst hurricane in the world fucking flattens your hospital and you have elderly patients to deal with, and you have, and just no one knows what the fuck to do. So they're kind of making it up as they go along. And it really has that kind of, you're watching this thing unfold in the most terrifying way, and it just is so well done. You're right, the dialogue is so believable, the performances are all so naturalistic. It's really, and yet it does have undoubtedly a disaster movie quality to it as well. And I actually love disaster movies. It's one of my favorite genres. I completely like Towering Inferno. I saw when I was like 6 years old. It's still one of my favorite films. And this does unashamedly establish this group of characters in a slightly, you'd say, soapy way, but it's not really soapy at all. It's just showing you these characters and what, you know, as fully rounded personalities, and then thrust them into this horrific disaster in very much disaster movie style. But that means that the storytelling is unbelievably gripping. And I, like you, by the end of the first episode, I just had to carry on watching. Well, you didn't want to.
But I really wanted to.
You were busy than me. I did carry on watching, and I watched episode two, then I watched episode three, and it just is a phenomenal piece of work. It's just absolutely spectacularly brilliantly done.
And as you say, it does that classic disaster thing where we know what's happening. And they're like, oh, it's going to be fine. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We will be fine. We have a couple of days. You should get a bit wet. And you're just like, oh, shit. But that ratcheting of tension, I think there's that cathartic moment when they realize that they are in the shit. Yeah. And it's just the pivot that they do there. There's a bit with a walkway, which actually really reminded me of the walkway in the Dark Knight. You know, the Dark Knight Hospital, the Joker blows up. Remind me of that. There's a bit with a walkway, which is really full on, which separates two parts of the hospital. And it becomes clear, should we say, that walkway is not going to last. But yeah, it's really tense. It's beautifully done. And I had the same thing as you. I was watching this. I don't know how they did this at certain points. I mean, sure, CGI will have been a factor into it. But even then, I'm like, there are people in the flooded city. Like, how? Anyway, suffice to say, it's extremely well done. It is lavish, isn't it, Boyd? It is. Yeah, it's a good one.
And I think Cherry Jones is the fascinating one, because she's the one I met who's stuck there trying to work out what the fuck to do. And she's just fantastic in the role. And it's so interesting. These are all real people, by the way. These are real people whose stories were told in that book.
Yeah.
And that adds that whole other layer to it as well. We should say it's directed by John Ridley and Colton Cuse, and they have done and written and directed by the two of them together, who have done brilliant stuff. John Ridley wrote the script for 12 Years a Slave, etc. But they have done a phenomenal job. I can't imagine this being done better than it is.
That's a good point.
Of course, Beth would rather have seen Ryan Murphy have a crack at it, but
was going to say that only makes me happier that it didn't get. Anyway,
one final embargo thing, right? This is true. When I first watched the screeners of this, the Apple. This is again the Apple screeners portal said the embargo was like Monday, I think, when we came out. But now it says now it says David Lee. It's definitely changed. And no one's told me that the embargo. I've written a review of it, a 5-star review in Heat, and they haven't complained to me. So I'm just preempting any complaint about this review of this show that may have been embargoed. I don't know.
But it wasn't embargoed initially, but they may have subsequently embargoed.
I guarantee you, I went into the portal and it said embargoed. The date was fine. I was allowed to. That's why I wrote a full review of it in Heat. It's already out, published. So fuck knows what's going on. But apologies in advance to anyone at Apple who gets annoyed that we've broken our second embargo of our three reviews. Yeah.
Well, if they keep moving embargoes, I don't know what we're supposed to do about that.
But, exactly.
Well, that is 5 days at Memorial, which lands on Apple TV Plus on Friday and may or may not be embargoed. Finally, this week, though, we have a show that is not embargoed because it is, in fact, out. It was embargoed, which is why you guys didn't do it last week. But this is The Sandman, based on Neil Gaiman's 1989 comic book, which, to be honest, should leave very little introduction. This is often described in the same breath as Watchmen, as kind of like the Citizen Kane of the comic book medium. It is weird, it is captivating, it's very often horrifying, and it is downright deranged at times. This is the story of Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, and his quest to regain his realm. Now, who better to talk about this than our very own Lord of Dreams, the man who single-handedly sent Stephen Frears to the Dreaming, Mr. Boyd Hilton.
That was good. I like that. That was really good.
That was very good. Wow.
Whatever you're about to say is wrong. Can we just get that out there right now?
Yeah.
It's wrong.
Yeah. Put it this way, I think it's interesting that it's taken decades to get this fucking thing on screen, right? There's a reason for that. Because the whole concept... I mean, for example, right, compared to Watchmen, I know the film of the Watchmen, I enjoyed it. But the TV show is a masterpiece.
Yes.
Yeah.
The TV series of Watchmen is an object lesson in how to take a very difficult, challenging set of original graphic novels or whatever and turning it into television drama. By doing something completely different. And it just used the characters in a way. And this, which I imagine I've not read, funnily enough, the graphic novels, comic books, whatever you want to call them. Yeah.
Oh, you're testing him?
Yeah, I am testing him. Already,
it's often described as a graphic novel. It's in so many volumes, I'm just calling it a comic. I sometimes think, there is a distinction between the two, though. I think I'm slightly woolly on what that is.
Well, if you're woolly, then you imagine me. Well, exactly. That's good to know.
Let's just call it a comic.
I'm glad you're woolly on it.
I would call it a comic.
Right. This has such a kind of, what's the word for it, flighty, tenuous, central concept, because you have to buy into the idea that Tom Sturridge's character, Morpheus / Dream, the King of Dreams, the ruler of the Dreaming, blah, 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 he's not a god, he's not a superhero, he's a kind of being and this is my own, you know, interpretation. I'm sure James can correct me. He's a kind of being
sure
who rules the our dream world. So everyone dreams, and we have to buy into the idea that the dream state that we all have, just dreaming, is a state, is a way. Oh God, I'm already losing it because it's so difficult. It's such a difficult, tenuous thing to try and to get a hook onto. And he is the personification, if you like, of the dream world. I think that's what he is. Anyway, you're kind of introduced to him in the first episode in this wild scene, very entertaining scene actually, where in like 1916, there's this weird occult ritual being played out by Charles Dance, who's brilliantly entertaining, as Sir Roderick Burgess, a charlatan occultist, and him and his son, who he hates, and his son, his poor son, is kind of like, you know, trying to please him, and he's annoyed with him. And they somehow rustle up the dream Morpheus character played by Tom Sturridge, and for some reason they put him in a glass case for 100 years, and he's naked for almost the entire first episode.
Yeah. Chilly.
And you don't really know why. I couldn't really work out why they were doing that, but he is. And then in the second episode, which I've carried on watching it because I had to go, right, or I think I have a clue what's going on, and then I'll carry on, maybe I have more of a clue. He returns to his dream world that he created himself with his sidekick, you know, character who is, you know, Vivian Achimpong.
Lucien, yes.
Yeah, Lucien. And she's like the only person in his like world who's had the patience to wait for 160 years or whatever for him to return. And then we meet other people who all have kind of like living in the dream world, I think, because they
Cain
have
and Abel. Legends.
Yeah, they have a... Oh, I love them. Yeah, they have a gargoyle that is like a little walking, talking...
Bless him.
...gargoyle thing. Cool. What's he called again?
Gregory.
Yeah, Gregory, which is quite amusing. So there's a kind of... tonal, you know, once they come in episode two, there's a kind of slightly almost comic, wryly funny tone, which I've seen Neil Gaiman try and do before.
Wow!
Savage,
not convinced that it's that funny. But at least it's like, it ends up being slightly less pompous than, because the first episode is really like everyone's delivering their lines in that portentous way of like, you know, particularly Dream, played by Tom Stone. Tom Stone is,
he doesn't speak for the first episode.
No, I mean, he speaks a bit, you're right, but then in the second episode he makes up for it with lots of holding forth, lots of chat. In that kind, again, any kind of, this kind of speaks in a very loud, a whispery, I then hold forth to this return, where has everyone gone to my dream world,
right,
kind of thing. And it's just, and then the psychic says at one point, you are the dreaming is you. Things like that. And you're like, oh, what does that mean? What does anything mean? The problem with it is I couldn't get a handle on it, as I think I've conveyed, hopefully.
I'm getting that impression. Yeah,
I found the concept so difficult to get a handle on, and why I should care, or what are the stakes? Because it seems once you enter this, the problem for me with all these things, what particularly a thing with dream with films and shows where there's loads of CGI dream stuff going on, as there, believe me, there is in this, is that why should you care about any of it? Like, what? Who gives a shit? Like, because it has no. So the, going back to the reason why I brought out Watchmen,
I'm having my breeder's moment.
Calm, stay calm. The reason why I brought up the Watchmen comparison is because that was grounded in an absolute reality.
Yeah.
And it flies off into incredible, like, you know, naked blue man in the middle of it, right? Fine.
Yeah.
But because it takes the time and effort and the brilliant writing to establish a world that has a connection to our living world experience, our lived experience, it totally works. This is no connection at all for me. I had no connection at all to anything. Yeah. I could not get a handle on any of it. I couldn't even get a handle on why we're being shown one set of characters and then cuts to another set of characters. There didn't seem any connection between them at all, the Jolie Richardson character. A lot. What the fuck's she doing? And suddenly she has a power to do something as well. That she seems like a normal human being, and then she's do you know what I mean? I'm problem with it for me is I really wanted to like it.
But it baffled you.
It baffled me, and I don't think it establishes. I think it is deeply flawed. It does not establish any stakes whatsoever for anyone in it, and I don't know understand who I'm rooting for. What I'm supposed to be interested in, and there's nothing in it that made me want to carry on watching it. I'm sorry.
Okay, well,
that's it. I feel like I'm going to step into diffuse because
Wade in, Beth.
I've seen this happen before quite recently. But also, just to say, I'm largely actually, do you know what? I'm worried because I think I'm going to rile you up even more. He's got the wide eyes. He's got a sort of grimace. He's got a gargoyle look.
I've gone full Gregory.
That's to say, I do. The one caveat is I really liked, so as a courtesy to James, because I anticipated something like this happening, I watched three episodes.
Oh, wow.
And Jenna Coleman is fucking excellent in this. Okay. Jenna Coleman is fucking great. Just about saved it for me.
Right.
Just about, but I agree with every single thing you're saying. And to add to that, it looked like BBC, tea time telly. It looked, James is like, head is basically split in two.
Maybe having an aneurysm.
It looked like a BBC, like a Sunday
six or
7 p.m. drama.
It doesn't look like
a massive Netflix budget show at all.
I think it does.
Even the gargoyle, Gregory was cute.
Gregory,
he had a cute face.
Yeah, I'll grant you, Gregory is not the best deployment of CGI.
And the whole first episode to me looked like it belonged on like BBC about 7 o'clock on a Saturday, Sunday. I was really surprised. I was expecting beautiful, fantastic, like lush palettes and like exotic worlds and dreams, like the stuff of dreams. And instead it feels like just a very like local British, like British made kind of, like a BBC budget, BBC drama.
You're just upsetting me now. You're just upsetting me.
I'm doing my duties. I'm doing my job. And now I'm going to run and just hide under this table while you just like spew.
I'm just going to say, to quote Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi, everything you just said is wrong. So this
to quote
is,
yourself, really.
This is a stone cold fucking masterpiece.
Was it ever going to be anything else for you?
Peerless example of how to take an unadaptable thing and turn it into a glorious 10-part television show. I thought this was absolutely magnificent, and I can't say enough good things about it. I think he is perfectly cast, Tom Sturridge, in a role that is very, very hard to cast, but he inhabits Dream, the character, so beautifully. The thing that I've always had with Sandman, so Sandman is one of these incredible comics. The only thing that's ever put me off Sandman is I don't get on with the art style. And that's not a very popular opinion, and Helen has yelled at me many times about this, but the art style of it just doesn't quite gel with me. And so actually getting this story but seeing it in this sort of lush, lavish Netflix production, which looks like it spent all the money in the world on it and the BBC can only dream of doing, I just loved it. I cannot tell you how much I love this, and I love this for all the reasons that Boyd hated it, which is because it is dense and it is completely disconnected from our reality with almost no points of crossover, and it's this incredible bit of world building that you can just immerse yourself in, and there's so many different levers to hold on to of stuff that's just like terms like the endless and the dreaming and all this sort of stuff, and it's like the mythology for me to just hoover up and digest was just absolutely wonderful for me. I was ecstatic about it. But more than that, like the way the comic is episodic, the way you start off with this guy who's been captured for 100 years and imprisoned, and then he has to go and he has to regain his amulet. He's got to regain his bag of sand. He's got to regain his helmet. And like, so they're very specific quests he has to go on. Each episode of this show is completely, not standalone, but it is self-contained quest. It is a self-contained thing that he goes on, so it has a different flavor. It has different actors. It has a different environment. So you have him essentially not speaking in a glass sphere for the first episode, and it's all about Charles Dance and his son. It's all about their relationship, and they've got this member of the Endless in their basement, and they keep him there, and the effect that it has on the broader world when the Lord of Dreams is not available, which sets up stuff to come. Boyd Holbrook plays the Corinthian, who is a demonic dream. He's a nightmare manifest. He's a manifest nightmare with teeth for eyes, which is deeply upsetting. But he has a smaller role in the comic, and now he's been spread out more in this. He's introduced earlier. He has much more to do. So they've made him a more persistent villain through this, which I think was a very, very smart move. But that second episode, you have Dream returning to the dreaming, and you have Cain and Abel, and you have all of that stuff going on. But then you get into, which I loved, which was episode 3, which is Joanna Constantine, not John Constantine from the comics, partly because I didn't have the rights to the character, I think, but also I think it's a wonderful idea to make her a different character from that family, and she's fantastic in that episode. And then you go into the fourth episode, which is Hell, which is Gwendolyn Christie as Lucifer, and it's Dream Goes to Hell. So each one of these has a completely separate flavour, and they are all fucking magnificent. I don't know what is wrong with you. They're just wonderful. I could not get enough of this. I am obsessed with it. I can't stop thinking about it. This is slammed into my top five of the year with a bullet. Like, I absolutely love this show. And I just think, I would never have thought it was possible to adapt that comic. And I think they've just done a masterful job. I am slightly concerned about what's going to happen when we get to the, shall we say, diner sequence.
I don't know what it's talking about.
So I'm not quite sure how that's gonna go. Let's just say it's quite graphic and let's just leave it there. So and let's not fuck about. Like, this Sandman is a horror comic. It is a horror comic, and he's genuinely deeply disturbing and upsetting in places.
Nothing I've seen so far is remotely disturbing.
But it comes in there. I mean, even the Corinthian himself is quite a horrific character, but I suspect it's going to get more extreme as it goes along. So it's a very, very dark story, this is, with lots of very dark elements to it. So to a certain extent, this is not going to be a show for everyone. It's partly because you'll get people like yourself, Boyd, who like things like, you know how I like a non-bellend character to anchor me in the humanity of a show. I know you need a sliver of reality to cling to. You can't have 100%, but there has to be something that you can relate to. And I think it's a similar thing. You need something to hang on to. And this is very detached from our reality. It's a very separate plane of existence.
I think it's, for me, it's the emotional stakes that are lacking more than anything. And that maybe comes down to the fact that it is so far removed from reality. So maybe it's removed from humanity slightly. Like, I found that like Father Son story, and I'm really cold with Charles Dance and his son. Like, there's no salvaging that. And I think having like the protagonist in a literal glass case of emotion, but nobody can access. He's inaccessible for that first episode.
Literally.
It's even, you know, even the heartwarming moment between the son and the mother with David Thewlis. I just felt
David
quite
Thewlis.
Unmoved. But I mean, we were never going to agree on this.
You were never going to like this. You were never. I wonder whether Boyd might get it. I did wonder when I was watching it. I was thinking, because this is really dense fantasy stuff. I wondered whether you would struggle a bit with it. I was holding out hope that you might like it. But yeah, I loved this so much. I think it's just wonderful.
I mean, I'm happy for you.
Yeah, I'm happy for you. I just don't think. I'm slightly surprised by the extent to which you love it, I have to say. I mean, I think there's a whole, you know, if you have a huge huge attachment to a piece of work, you know, a piece of writing or what, and you're excited that it's being finally transferred to the screen.
But it makes you more critical as well.
Oh, no, I know, yeah. I know. But I think, like, I don't know, I just feel that you do have an attachment to it and an understanding of it that I think coming fresh to it do not have.
Yeah.
And while it tries to, I don't have a problem with something with a concept that is detached from our lived reality. It's more that if you are going to do that, you really have to work very hard at explaining the rules to us, explaining what these characters can and can't do. And I felt like it did not manage to do that. It did not manage to root it to any kind of alternate reality either. So it's not so much that I wanted it to, because again, I keep going back to this fucking Watchmen example, but it's a real skill. It's hard. It's really hard to get high fantasies, hardcore fantasy stuff, to get people to care about characters that are so divorced from reality, but it can be done. I just think this failed. I'm sorry. I think it really failed. And I think there's going to be a massive divide.
Oh, yeah.
I think the divide is going to be if you understand what the fuck is going on because you've read the original, what it's based on, fine. If you don't, I just think people are going to be bewildered.
And
not even particularly entertained. I think it's scene for scene. It's not, I mean, I literally am amazed that you said it was horror, because I'm not even remotely, and it doesn't seem to be any attempt to scare me in the first two episodes.
I don't think from the first two episodes you can really have an understanding of what the show is. I know it sounds really, but I genuinely don't think you can, because it evolves as it goes along. And I think by the time you get about halfway through the series, you've got more of a handle on it. But it's not until, I would say, the end of episode four, maybe, that I think you're really on steady ground with this.
Well, okay.
So I do think you need to press on to really get into it. I think you might be right in that understanding the source material. Obviously, I was never going to be baffled because I know what this is about. Helen is a huge, huge fan of Sam, and she loved this as well. So I think that probably does help. I don't think it's exclusionary. I don't think you won't like it if you haven't read the comic. I just think you maybe won't like it if you're not open to having like a landslide of fantasy world building shoved on your head. Hey, 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 hey.
This is classic.
You know, you said the same thing when we got into Breeders.
No, I'm stopping this right now.
That's calling it time. That's the end of.
I don't mind. I don't mind that accusation. That's fine. But I think that I just think, what was the other Neil Gaiman adaptation? You know, the Amazon Prime show that he was involved with, which was Neil Gaiman and do you know what I mean?
Good Omens, the Terry Pratchett.
Good Omens, right. Yeah. Now, Good Omens, scene for scene, is funny and engaging and silly. Its tone is there from the start.
Oh, it's nothing
right?
like this.
No, I know, but I'm just like,
he's involved.
There is
in
a connection.
It,
he's involved.
That's the
in
only
it.
Connection. It's, all right. It's pure Pratchett, that is.
Okay, but I just think it's not succeeding in what it's setting out to do. I just don't think it is so far.
And I respectfully disagree.
Yeah, but it's funny enough because the listener question...
And let's keep it that way.
The listener question touched on how long you give shows, didn't it, that we were going to do.
Yes.
Maybe we'll do it next week because
we'll
it is pertinent.
But if
it's going to take four episodes...
Yeah,
but I think with Netflix, it's less of an issue. When they all drop at once, I think, you know, people spend 4 hours watching all kinds of shit. So I think you could 100% give this.
But I gave this three episodes. I did give it three. Yeah.
I'll watch it for the cast because I'll watch it for Jenna Coleman, and it's got fantastic people in it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Gwen Stefani.
So many good people.
Do you know what? I'm going to carry on watching it.
Get to end of episode four.
I just had no. It's a visceral thing, isn't it? You get to the end of an episode of a TV show. I had no. Literally, there was a lack of visceral need to carry on watching it.
Well, I can't wait for round two of this next
week.
Well,
the unqualified masterpiece that is The Sandman on Netflix is available to stream now. Make sure you watch every episode because it is unmissable. What else is out this week, Boydie?
Right, well, we've got Shetland, season 7.
Jesus.
Can you believe? Doogie Henshaw on the Isle of Shetland. This is his last series. They're carrying on the show without him, so there'll be more of it. But Shetland is definitely an above-average crime thriller. So it's back on Wednesday the 10th on BBC One at 9 o'clock. Lock and Key, the aforementioned.
Yeah, the final season.
Final season.
Of the show that may or may not have fairies in it.
Yeah, and I mean, I've said it before and I'll say it again. People get annoyed when I point this out. It's on Wednesday, 10th of August on Netflix, not Friday. it always has significance, I think. And Rami, I would mention, which has been previously shown on Stars Play, is a really good show. It's season 2. It arrives on Channel 4 on Friday, the 12th of August, 11:05 p.m. That is the show starring Rami Youssef, who's a stand-up, an American Muslim stand-up and actor, and it's all about him and the American Muslim community, and it's very, very funny and perceptive. And this season has Mahershala Ali as well joining the cast, and you can't want more than that.
Great stuff.
I think that's mostly it.
Yeah.
And what is our pick of the week? I suspect we may be split.
I mean, it's 5 days of Memorial.
I mean, I can't even say what my pick of the week is, so I'll just have to not answer.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, if you were allowed to have reviewed it, it probably would have been.
Best pick of the week is the interview she did for A League of Their Own.
Yeah.
And mine is, of course, The Sandman.
Yeah.
No shocks there. But that is it for episode 198.
Jesus.
As basic arithmetic will attest, we are growing terrifyingly close to the big 200. Obviously, we would love to celebrate with you all in person. So if you haven't yet got your tickets, do go and get them immediately. And, you know, I don't take the excuse, hey, James, I'd love to come, but I live thousands of miles away in a different country and it's just not practical. Nonsense! There are planes. There are boats. There are jetpacks. Find a way. We will also accept bribes in the way of a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, which would, of course, get you absolutely nothing apart from our goodwill, but we would like them anyway. Find all the links for Pilot 200, of course, on my Twitter at James C. Dyer, and follow all three of us both on Twitter and Instagram, of course, at Beth K. Webb and at Boyd Hilton. Next week, we'll have episode 199, when it'll be Beth's turn to be on holiday. So we will have to struggle through there, which will be helped, I think, in part because this very podcast will have 1 degree of Kevin Bacon as of next week, as Kevin will be on the show to talk about all things City on a Hill. Until then, though, I have 6 episodes of Better Call Saul, 5 episodes of The Sandman, and most crucially, the entire final season of C to watch. Justice for Bubba Voss, redemption for Tamukti Jun. Let's do this thing. Pilot out.